From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Lobbyists are influencing legislation in unprecedented ways. On today's Fresh Air, we take a look at how lobbying works with Alex Knott. He runs the Lobby Watch Project for the Center for Public Integrity. Since 1998, lobbyists have spent more than $13 billion trying to influence Congress and federal agencies. If that makes you want to scream, you'll want to listen to the advice of our guest, Melissa Cross. She's a vocal coach who teaches metal and punk performers how to sing and scream without ruining their vocal cords. And rock historian Ed Ward remembers the singer Nico. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. With several lobbying scandals in play, we thought this was a good time to take a look at how lobbying works and the increasing power lobbyists have in the writing of legislation. Last week, we focused on the investigations into lobbyists Jack Abramoff and Michael Scanlon. Today, we're going to talk with someone whose job is monitoring lobby groups. Alex Knott is the Lobby Watch project manager for the Center for Public Integrity. Knott was also the project manager for the Center for Public Integrity's investigative book, The Buying of the President, 2004. Do you have an example or a story, you know, that crystallizes how lobbying works and why you think it sometimes goes too far?
Well, there was a situation where a former Florida senator named Connie Mack put forward a legislation that would help out Bacardi on some trademark issues that it was having with Cuba. And the bill was put forward and was passed, and it was a special section, just a small, short section, that was put forth and written by Bacardi. Well, this legislation was passed, and Connie Mack, when he retired, he went to go work for, you guessed it, Bacardi, working on this to keep the legislation that he passed into law to continue to be the law so that Bacardi would be helped on that legislation. So it's a funny situation where sometimes members of Congress will take an action which later gets rewarded when they move to K Street.
It sounds like lobbyists are influencing legislators in almost unprecedented ways. Some people are saying that lobbyists are almost writing the bills with the legislators. What have you learned about new ways that lobbyists are influencing legislation?
Well, a lot of times they will write legislation. Sometimes they just write an amendment, which will get slipped in during a committee markup. It'll only be a few sentences to a bill, but sometimes it can have a massive effects, either in regulation, which will save an industry billions of dollars, or sometimes contracts, which will be handed out through a sole source, no bid situation that will help a company directly. For a long period of time, there has been a lot of lobbyists that have played a role in formulating legislation, but these days they are writing it directly. Not every piece of legislation that's put out there, but there were 7,000 bills between the House and the Senate during the last congressional session, and many of those are written by lobbyists, largely.
The center did a year-long study on global pharmaceutical corporations. And concluded that pharmaceutical corporations spent more than $800 million in federal lobbying and campaign donations in the past 7 years. What impact did the pharmaceutical lobby have on the Medicare prescription drug benefit?
Well, there were a couple bills that were being put forth. The Democrats wanted lower prices and things that would require more regulation of the pharmaceutical industry. And the Republican-sponsored bill was a little bit more industry-friendly. And this ended up being the bill that passed. It was actually the president's initiative, and it was the president's prescription Medicare drug plan. This was the one that ended up passing, and everybody from pharmaceutical companies to the American Medical Association to the AARP weighed in on this. And at the end of the day, the pharmaceutical companies got at least a closer version of the legislation that they wanted, and it helped them out.
What do they want, and how did they get it?
There were many things that they wanted. One of the biggest things is that they wanted patent extensions, and this was part of the bill. Another thing that they wanted was making sure that no drugs came in through the exportation from Canada. This was another part of the bill. But instead of making the pharmaceuticals lose part of their profits, what happened is largely the federal government picked up the tab for this, and it saved the pharmaceutical companies from both regulation and loss in profits.
I don't know if this is a question that you can actually answer, but how much do you think the pharmaceutical lobby was behind, was the inspiration for the Medicare prescription drug bill?
Well, there's a lot of situations where they list lobbying the bill very early in the session. So one would believe that people from the pharmaceutical industry had a direct role with its inception. You know, there are a lot of groups pharmaceutical companies being some of them, that lobby the White House directly. For instance, the Bioindustry Organization, or Biotechnology Industry Organization, rather, which represents many pharmaceutical makers, has been one of, they're the 13th largest group that has lobbied the White House directly. So many of the things that come out in the president's proposals are lobbied on directly by industries, and then they take the form of legislation or an initiative. Sometimes it could be even something that could be an executive order that's put forth, like the Healthy Forest Initiative was originally an executive order until it passed as an act. So there are many little things like this that are, you know, that are lobbied by lobbyists that, that come into the White House and come in and out, and sometimes even buy trips for people that work as staffers.
Do you have any idea of what the pharmaceutical lobby did to influence legislators who were voting on the Medicare prescription drug plan?
Well, sure. They hired a lot of well-connected people. I don't have these figures directly in front of me, however. A lot of times they'll hire people that have revolving door links to members of Congress. And revolving doors, you know, something that's understood inside the Beltway, but to explain it, there are about 10,000 people that work for members of Congress as staffers. And then, of course, you have members of Congress, and then a huge amount of people that also work for the federal government. We have found that there have been 2,200 people that have registered as lobbyists that have worked for the government prior. And a lot of times they'll have a connection to a member of Congress who's going to vote on one of these bills or amend or support some of this legislation. So by hiring some of the friends and the people that are well-connected to members of Congress that are going to weigh in on this legislation, they are often able to change the votes and shift the focus and shift the debate on legislation like the Prescription Drug Act. So using revolving doors and hiring lobbyists that are very well-connected can be the most succinct way of changing how things are viewed by Congress.
So you're hiring people who have access to the people who are voting.
That's exactly it. Some of the friends and former colleagues, we found that there are 236 former members of Congress that have registered since 1998, and they can walk onto the House and Senate floor and discuss things with members of Congress. Now, they're not supposed to lobby them directly there or in the cloakrooms or in the speaker's lobby or in the president's room. But these facilities that basically only members of Congress can go to, and former members of Congress that are now lobbyists, are really exclusive. And this is a situation where former members can have an extraordinary power to influence a lawmaker's views.
Now, I want to get back to something we were talking about a moment ago, which is that some bills are virtually written, or some amendments within bills are virtually written by lobbyists. I don't really understand how that works. If you're a legislator, do you just say to a lobbyist, hey, you write this for me, and I'll just put it in? I mean, how do lobbyists get to actually write parts of bills?
Well, a lot of times a member of Congress will weigh in with an industry to at least understand their perspective before going forward and proposing and writing legislation, and which is a good value judgment. You kind of want to know how things are going to affect teachers, so you might want to talk to a teacher group and just talk to them and understand that. And that's something that takes place with some types of lobbying. However, a lot of times lobbying groups will just put forward legislation, and they'll find a member of Congress who often values their judgment so much so that they basically submit almost all of the language. And it'll get written up by their legislative writers, you know, over at Ford in the House or corresponding buildings in the Senate. And then the legislation will come forward, and you won't even see the lobbyist fingerprints on it by the end of the day. You won't know who put forward this bill.
Is it hard to establish a direct quid pro quo between a lobbyist and a legislator?
It's very hard. One of the reasons that it's hard to get these quid pro quos and really prove them is because lobbyists' disclosure is pretty weak. You only have to submit every 6 months. And if I started lobbying on something in, let's say, January, you wouldn't find out about it until mid-October, probably at the earliest, just because you only have to file every 6 months, and it takes a while for those records to get in the system. By then, the legislation could have been passed already, and it's no longer newsworthy, so the press doesn't have any reason to necessarily cover who's lobbying on a certain issue, and they don't have any way to really track it in any real time. there's a few bills in the House that are looking at this currently, and they're trying to increase the filing requirements, make them happen quarterly instead of semi-annually, and also to try to make it electronically filed, which is something that is being considered, though we're not advocating anything on either way on that.
My guest is Alex Knott. He runs the Lobby Watch Project at the Center for Public Integrity. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Alex Knott. He's the Lobby Watch Project Manager for the Center for Public Integrity in Washington, D.C. Let's talk about the K Street Project. From what I've read, it's my understanding that this is an initiative to make sure that lobby groups are staffed largely or exclusively by Republicans and to basically get rid of Democrats in lobby groups. What's your understanding of the K Street Project?
Well, basically, this is an initiative that's been put forward by former House Majority Leader Tom DeLay and Rick Santorum and GOP strategist Grover Norquist. And the idea is basically that different lobbying firms on K Street and otherwise hire as many Republicans as possible and almost exclude Democrats from the process. Basically, now, since the Republicans have control of the White House, the Senate, and the House, there's almost one more house that could be taken, and that would be the lobbying house, basically K Street.
An article in the Washington Monthly said the lobbies have become a Republican political machine. Does that sound accurate to you?
To a certain extent, it is, and there's a reason that there is so much pressure to make these groups Republican. A lot of times when a member of Congress wants to retire, they want to get a very lucrative job on K Street. Sometimes just being a member of Congress is a resume builder for an ultimately much more lucrative job on K Street, such as members of Congress only receive about $160,000, and it's difficult to say only attached to that, but you can make, you know, well over $1 million being a former member of Congress who lobbies. So this can really set them up, and not only that can it set them up, but it can set up their staffs. You know, there's nearly 10,000 people that work on the Hill, and Republicans want other Republicans to staff those positions on K Street.
Does the K Street Project represent a new direction in lobbying? I mean, for example, in the classic relationship between lobbyist and legislator, the lobbyist wants a certain legislation passed that will help their industry, and in return, they might give some kind of favor to the legislator. But what the K Street Project is doing is they're pushing at the lobbyists to do political things, to have a political direction. Does that represent something new?
I think it does, in that it's so organically partisan. You know, lobbyists have always been in the business of providing favors to members of Congress. Many times these favors take the form of a trip or possibly a campaign contribution. But actually formulating staffs that would behoove a lawmaker, well, that's kind of a new thing. At least it's the first time it's ever happened on such a massive scale as with the K Street Project. I'm sure that, you know, there have been situations in the past where certain lobbying firms are very business-friendly or more Republican-based or more labor union-friendly / Democratic-based. But on a whole-scale market, when you look at the lobbying industry, and that's really what it is, it's an industry, to see something this massive and on this scale, this is kind of a new thing. This is a situation where they're actually actively going out and changing their hiring practices to only hire Republicans, many times hiring Republicans that were former staff members of the people that they are trying to influence. So it actually somewhat behooves them, because now they can hire a lobbyist who is going to be able to go to that former member and have this working relationship with them. But it also helps them out because they're doing a favor for these members of Congress, which is, you know, tantamount to any campaign contribution. It's also equal to any large favor like a trip.
Jack Abramoff and Michael Scanlon are involved in a big lobbying scandal right now involving their work on behalf of Indian tribes who run or want to run casinos. What would you say have been their trademarks as lobbyists? Like, what sets them apart from what other lobbyists have done?
Well, I think the number one thing is the dollars that they charged for their services. The amount of money that they charged these Indian tribes were completely out of character for lobbying. They were so high that many people on K Street laughed at how much they were receiving. You know, I've even spoke to a former member of Congress who is a lobbyist now, and they've dealt with some of their clients. And they just were blown away by how much Mr. Abramoff was charging their clients. It was just amazing. And even many of the people that are on K Street were kind of ready for, you know, an indictment to take place, because it was kind of giving the rest of the lobbyists, believe it or not, a bad name.
They've been indicted for defrauding the Indian tribes that they represented. Do you see what they've done as just being greedy, or do you see it as part of a larger direction that lobbying has headed in?
Well, lobbying is a direction that lobbying is headed in. Lobbying has increased over the years to a large amount. In 1998, $1.4 billion was spent lobbying the federal government. During 2004, $2.1 billion was spent lobbying the federal government. Right now, lobbying's unregulated, and you can charge as much as you want to lobby on behalf of somebody. And it's kind of a free agency situation where if you feel that you deserve a certain rate, you can ask for it. And if, as long as the corporation is willing to pay for it, you can get the money and then lobby. It's a new ground. Companies have realized that lobbying equates to less than pennies on the dollar, whether it's a new initiative that could be environmental, that could cost energy companies billions of dollars, or whether it's a situation where pharmaceuticals have less regulation, or even another situation where large defense contractors can receive, you know, billions of dollars in contracts by only spending millions of dollars lobbying.
You know, in the relationship between lobbyists and legislators, how much do you think that lobbyists are just relying on their powers of persuasion? They're experts in the field. They know what their industry wants. And how much of it is actually like buying favor?
Well, a large amount of it is buying favor. We found that there are a lot of lawmakers that have put lobbyists in charge of their campaign committees and leadership PACs. For instance, you know, there's almost 80 members of Congress who have appointed lobbyists to be the treasurers of their campaign committees. And basically, since they control the purse strings of their reelection, they have this overwhelming favor from that member of Congress. It goes way beyond any campaign contribution if you control a member of Congress's campaign committee. And that's something that's happened over and over on Capitol Hill, between K Street and Capitol Hill. But sometimes a lobbyist's best friend is the information that they carry. A lot of times the lobbyist knows the most about this bill, many times because they wrote it, you know, because there's so many bills, because these bills are hundreds to thousands of pages long. Members of Congress rely upon lobbyists more and more to get their opinions so that they can comprehensively understand what's in these bills. The only thing is while these lobbyists are, you know, informing these members of Congress, they are often twisting the facts to benefit their industry.
Senator McCain said on our show this week that he plans to introduce legislation to further regulate lobby groups. What kind of regulation of lobby groups would you like to see?
Well, while the Center for Public Integrity doesn't advocate anything, I think that a lot of campaign finance and lobbying reform advocates would like to see more transparency to the system. Something that happens semi-annually, it is not a real-time situation where a democracy can have an understanding of who's affecting their democracy. They probably would want a longer cooling-off period so that so many of these proverbial revolving doors that you hear about wouldn't take place immediately and kind of negate many of the conflicts of interest that take place. I think a lot of people are looking to stem the tide of trips that are being paid for members of Congress, so that situations where Jack Abramoff is paying for a member of Congress to go play golf in Scotland wouldn't exist anymore. And also, you would probably see a lot more situations where the forms would be more transparent, so that you could actually see more or less what legislation is actually being affected by the lobbyists as it was being affected.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Alex Knott runs the Lobby Watch Project at the Center for Public Integrity. I have a correction to make. On Tuesday, during my interview with Senator John McCain, while we were discussing how current ethics, bribery, and corruption investigations are affecting the Republican Party, I mentioned the name of Congressman Bob Ney. I mistakenly said that the congressman had resigned. He has not. Congressman Ney is still in office and is running for re-election. I regret the error. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of The Narrative of Sojourner Truth, an African-American Testament, part of Barnes & Noble Classics, available in stores and online. From Audible.com, pray you can download and listen to NPR programs like Fresh Air, in addition to audiobooks, magazines, and newspapers. Audible.com/Fresh Air. And from ESPN, presenting Codebreakers, an original movie on West Point's honor code and its football legacy, Saturday at 9 p.m. Eastern on ESPN. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
You need cool air, baby, I'm not fool air.
Coming up, how to growl and scream without damaging your vocal cords. We talk with vocal coach Melissa Cross. She works with punk and heavy metal performers. She has a new instructional DVD. Also, rock historian Ed Ward remembers Nico.
I'm gonna give you my love. Oh, want a whole lot of love. 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 You've been learning. Baby, I've been learning. Oh, all that good time, baby, baby. I've been the dirt bed. Way, way down inside. Oh, honey, you need a. I'm gonna give you my love. I'm gonna give you my love. Oh, a whole lot of love.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Screaming punk and heavy metal vocals may sound like they hurt, and often they do.
You're lost, looking in the darkness, one which I despise, looking in the shadow, I fear. Let's go!
That's the band Anon. Now, sounds like that can really damage your voice. My guest, Melissa Cross, is a vocal coach who works with punk and metal performers, teaching them how to scream and shout and bellow without hurting their vocal cords. She doesn't want them to sound like Pavarotti or sing on Broadway. She just wants to prevent them from hurting themselves and ruining their careers. One of the bands she works with is Lamb of God. Here's how the lead singer sounded after she coached him. It might not sound much different from the previous scream, but it probably feels a lot better.
Now you need something to die for. Now you need something to die for.
Vocal coach Melissa Cross has an instructional DVD. It's called The Zen of Screaming. Melissa Cross, welcome to Fresh Air. What are some of the typical problems that you think metal singers and punk singers have with their voices?
Well, first of all, they imitate their heroes. So they start young, they listen to their favorite CDs, and they try to replicate that sound in an imitative way. And what that does is it makes them use the wrong muscles to do it. That's the big problem. The other thing is the contrivance of actually making it sound violent or sound like anything. They usually associate that sound with tension. So they are unable to disassociate the tension of the emotion with the actual execution of the sound. So that causes vocal damage. You can't finish a tour.
What's some of the typical damage that metal and punk singers have?
Well, it starts out with, like, chronic swelling, and that swelling often turns into nodules, polyps, cysts, and that is because of the just overuse. In other words, the vocal cords tap together, and when you bang them together because they're always swollen, in other words, to get a result, the scar tissue develops on the actual vocal fold. That's called a nodule. And sometimes it's a fluid-filled injury, which is a polyp. And the results of those two things are the same. The actual polyp or nodule closes before the vocal cords close together. And you get this air. So it goes like, hi, hi. See, like there's a delay on the cord closing. So they walk around like that and try to finish a tour. And basically they end up not being able to say anything. It's just like, hi, that kind of thing. So that's all from poor execution, but also it often happens when kids party a lot, they don't sleep well, they get sick, and they're compromised by some other health problem on the road, and then they do that kind of stressful, scar-invoking technique, and it becomes problematic when there's a lot of money on the line for the tour.
Is there a way to scream without shredding your vocal cords? Maybe you could give us a demonstration of a scream that you think is not damaging and a scream that you think is damaging.
Okay, I'll explain. The scream that does not damage is the scream that identifies the false vocal cords, which are actually located higher in the throat. The true cords, those are the ones that sing, right? The false cords are just distortion, and they're located higher in the throat. It's almost as if the powers that be, whoever, whatever created us, started an operation for vocal cords a little higher up and didn't finish them. So it's actually like higher up, it sounds like shrieking. Sounds like an animal. Right? That's the correct way.
That sounds to me like it might hurt.
It doesn't hurt a bit. Mm-hmm. If it hurt me, I wouldn't be able to say it doesn't hurt a bit, because I would say it hurt a bit, because I didn't use too much of my true vocal cords. Now, if I get all excited and try to sound really bad, like violent, and put the feeling in my throat that actually even I get when someone takes my parking space, then I'll tighten everything up in my body and go, like that. And I'm using too much gag reflex and too much pressure on my larynx. And that's what causes the swelling.
Now, the first way you did it, the way that you screamed that wouldn't hurt your voice, it did sound kind of like a weird beast. can you actually make that into singing?
When it has a note to it, I call that heat. And one of the advanced applications that I try to teach my clients so that they can really step up the bar on this particular genre of music is to be able to transfer from scream to singing within a note. So it's like, you know, like to keep going back and forth. Mm-hmm. So it's not all do, 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 and then, oh, do, do, you know, not back and forth like good cop, bad cop. But I really like the art of actually bringing that stuff in and pulling it out and bringing it in and pulling it out and doing it very artistically. There is a faction of the genre that does not appreciate any kind of pitch at all. And you will find as in any, you know, tribe-oriented music that they have, you know, they have like your death metal tribe, you have your metalcore tribe, you have these factions of kids that have separated themselves by virtue of the sound of their music. There's all these names they have for it. It's very funny.
My guest is vocal coach Melissa Cross. She has an instructional DVD called The Zen of Screaming. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is vocal coach Melissa Cross. She works with punk and metal vocalists, teaching them how to do screaming vocals without ruining their voices. She has an instructional DVD called The Zen of Screaming. Now, you were a trained singer, but then you ended up in a punk band in what, the 80s?
Yes, first time around.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Late 70s.
So how did you go from being a trained singer? What did you expect you'd be doing? Probably not being in a punk band.
Well, you know, it was my spirit that was, you know, going the punk way. I'm a singer-songwriter and, you know, put down my acoustic guitar and my Laura Ashley dress and my Joni Mitchell records and picked up an electric guitar and started shredding. And, you know, it was just around that time that, you know, we had, you know, the Sex Pistols. And I was living in England at the time, actually, so it was like The Jam and 999 and Susie and the Banshees and like all these like, you know, Stranglers. And that was beginning and I wanted to be a part of it. Now, what I had learned in vocal training absolutely had no context in that at all. There was singing, there was notes, but what I had learned to do was like all head resonance, which is the difference between what any kind of contemporary music involves more chest resonance instead of head resonance.
Demonstrate the difference for us.
Chest resonance is when I'm speaking to you. Head resonance is this. Now, that's in the speaking context. This is head. Now, in singing, if I go for my head resonance, I go, and if I'm in my full chest, it's like, right? It's a whole different sound. It's a higher larynx position. It sounds more like talking. It doesn't sound like, it sounds like, you know, more of that and the rocks and in the rock sense. I can do it, you know, a little less, you know, extremely. I mean, I can go, oh, you know, there's different, you know, I don't have to go straight to the rock thing, to the opera thing. There are some things in between. I had there is a right way to do this, and my teacher taught me this, and therefore I am supposed to do this and that to make a good sound. And that is what I had to throw out the window to get on stage and scream at CBGBs. And I hurt myself. I got a polyp. I did not have surgery. I healed myself through speech therapy. And it was through the speech therapy that I actually found out the missing link between the two.
And what did you find out?
The link between speaking and singing is the use of head resonance in speaking. If you use head resonance in speaking, then you are actually balancing the placement of the voice so that the throat is open. The overtones are there. Head resonance is overtone. If you take out the head resonance and put it all in your throat. You see, now I'm talking without any head resonance whatsoever. I didn't change the pitch, but you see, it's like really brassy, you know? It's like really, you know? But now I moved it up with head resonance in my speaking, and I was able to understand in a sensation way what it is to utilize head resonance without singing opera. So, and that's what I teach.
So had you been speaking in that more clenched throat kind of way that you just demonstrated before your speech lessons? Is that how you were talking?
Interesting question. I went to acting school in England, and I had this like really tiny little voice like this. And people said, you have to lower that voice. So I went down like this, and I tried to sound like Glenda Jackson. And I was like, you know, very like, oh, good morning, how are you? How are you? You know, Shakespeare, you know. And it was actually the wrong placement for my voice. Again, I was going for a certain texture or a sound, which I thought is what they wanted. So I moved my speaking voice down in my throat, which actually was not good for me. What really hurt me, though, was the screaming at CBGBs without any head resonance. Or, wait a second, let me back up here. There is no head resonance in screaming. It is produced correctly with the feeling that I produce head resonance. In other words, if I do, I'm going to put a pencil in my teeth now, mm-hmm. right? And I'm going to demonstrate the vowel E above the pencil and the vowel E below the pencil. Now, when I say below and above the pencil is going to be in my teeth, and I'm going to imagine, simply imagine, the E going over the pencil like this. E. Now, if I put vibrato with that, E, right? Now, this is below the pencil. E, E, right? It doesn't, it's squashier. It's more trebly. E, A, E, A, right? Mm-hmm. It's all an imaginative thing that I just did. All I did was just put in my imagination that I was throwing my voice in a certain way, and my body behaved. My larynx lowered in my throat. My breath pressure was absolutely in place, and I went beep beep instead of going right. And what that does is it places the voice without you slamming with too much chest register. If I go a a a, you hear my chords like bang bang bang, right? I'm not using the whole chord. I'm not using the whole vocal cord there, by the way. I'm only using a portion of the chord, and I'm using it much too violently.
You give your students certain images to use to help them really inflate their lungs and to take deep breaths from the diaphragm so that they get that full air supply. What are some of the images that you use?
I absolutely tell them never to think about the diaphragm. The diaphragm is actually a large muscle that is located up inside the rib cage, and its sole purpose is to draw air in and release air. You don't really need to think about it because when you were born, you came out and it worked just fine. So really to like overthink that is actually to stop the whole coordination or momentum of the process. Now, in exercises, you might want to like focus on how that works, but in performance, you would never ever think about your diaphragm. I prefer the Wagnerian school or the German school of singing, which I think is more conducive to rock singing. By the way, the diaphragmatic training is bel canto. That is a very common classical. It's the way I learned how to sing classical music. It's the most common vocal training. The other German school involves the lower rib cage, and it is by virtue of expanding the lower ribs out to the side while taking a breath and not engaging the muscles in the upper chest that you get a full breath. And it doesn't feel like a full breath because it doesn't, what people normally associate with a full breath is the lift of the upper chest. You take that big, right? And your breasts come up into your chin, right? And you think that's a big breath. Actually, that's too much air because you don't need that much air. Too much air makes you hold your breath. Just the right amount, which is determined by the expansion of the rib cage coordinated with the intake of air, just the right amount is manageable for this consistency. And that image for women, I call it strapless bra. And the breath is called a by the way. Now, these two go together. A by the way is if, say, you forgot to say something, you go, oh, by the way, hear that little breath? By the way, it's just a little tiny sip of air. And I, at the same time that I take that relaxed little sip, I boost my rib cage as though I need to keep a strapless bra from coming down under my skirt, under my dress. So a by the way in strapless bra is all the thinking my students are ever allowed to have about breathing.
So ever since you've been teaching, do you listen to music differently when you hear a singer? Are you hearing what's going right and what's going wrong in their singing from a more technical point of view?
Absolutely. But that's, you know, happens to everybody. I mean, when I studied acting for so many years, and when I go to a show, I can't help but, you know, pull it apart. You know, it's just, I enjoy it. And there are some singers that actually, you know, have allowed me to transcend everything. And I can go there. I can be transported. If it's really good, I won't be technical-minded because I'll be in so much awe of the feelings that I'm getting from the performance.
Who are some of your favorite singers now?
You know, I like different singers for different reasons. And it's usually the acting thing that really is what affects me. It's their phrasing. You know, I like Pavarotti. I like classical singers. I like Renee Fleming. I like, for opera, I like Kathleen Battle. I like all those singers, but within that genre. I like Tom Jones. His voice is amazing. I don't like his material at all, but I think he has the most amazing voice of all. I mean, one of the most amazing voices of all time. The guy has the most, I mean, the overtone in that guy's voice is unreal. Unreal. He sings a C above middle C, and it sounds like middle C because of the strength and the overtone in it. I want to meet Tom Jones. Chris Cornell is my favorite singer. That's who my favorite singer is.
Who is it?
Chris. He's a singer from a band formerly known as Soundgarden.
Oh,
now he's
yeah.
in a band with Audio Slave. Mm-hmm. Chris Cornell has been one of my favorite singers for a long time. But he's shredded himself to bits. He should have come to me.
Okay.
He's doing fine now, but way back when he shredded himself up.
Well, Melissa Cross, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Melissa Cross has an instructional DVD called The Zen of Screaming. You can find a link to her website on our website, freshair.npr.org. Coming up, rock historian Ed Ward on the singer Nico. This is Fresh Air. Nico was one of those mysterious figures of the swinging 60s. Was she an actress, a singer, or was she just a celebrity who popped up in the right places? Rock historian Ed Ward sat down with her early albums to try to figure it out.
Came your way and when he had to go, there were roses growing in the snow.
In the history of rock and roll, there are many odd careers, but few are as odd as that of Nico, a pop star who was never a star, really, and who mostly didn't do pop. She obscured her past, but it's known that her real name was Krista Pafkin, of Cologne's Pafkin Brewing family, whose restaurants still exist. Her parents were well enough off that she got a good education and ran with the European elite. And this explains how, at the age of 15, she found herself in Rome with a bit part in Fellini's La Dolce Vita. That led to a modeling career, which scandalized her family, but put her right in the middle of the swinging 60s. She had liaisons with famous men, including French actor Alain Delon, with whom she had a son, Ari. Moving to London, she took up with Brian Jones of the Rolling Stones, whose manager, Andrew Lou Goldham, signed her to his immediate label and tried to make a star out of her. Her voice wasn't really suited for Gordon Lightfoot songs like I'm Not Sayin', nor was she suited for life with Brian Jones, whom she left for Bob Dylan not long afterwards. By 1965, she was in New York, working again at acting and appearing in Andy Warhol's infamous film Chelsea Girls. Warhol had other plans for her, too. He'd just taken on the Velvet Underground, and after hearing her sing at a New York nightclub called the Blue Angel, he decided the band needed her icy good looks to complete their image. It worked for a while.
And what costume shall the poor girl wear to all tomorrow's parties? A hand-me-down dress from who knows where.
Put it mildly, neither Nico nor Lou Reed were easy people to get along with, and Reed considered her someone who'd been imposed on him. She famously stomped out on the group with a typically outrageous and anti-Semitic remark, but John Cale kept in touch. She put out a solo album, Chelsea Girl, featuring songs written for her by Reed, Bob Dylan, and her latest discovery, a 17-year-old kid from Southern California, Jackson Browne.
I don't do too much talking these days. These days I seem to think a lot about the things that I forgot to do. And all the times I had the chance to.
By 1968, Cale, too, had left the Velvets and helped her put together her next album, The Marble Index, which was all her own songs. To say that it was not what the pop world of the time was waiting for was no exaggeration.
Friar Hermit stumbles over the cloudy borderline. Frozen warnings close to mine. Close to the frozen borderline. Frozen warnings close to mine. Close to the frozen borderline.
Cale's arrangements brought out all of his avant-garde leanings, while Nico's compositions and vocal techniques harkened back to medieval times. Ignored totally by radio and the press, the Marble Index sold dozens of copies at the time. By now, Nico was living in a world of her own, and although she and Cale made one more album in the mid-70s, featuring a version of The Doors' The End, which became her signature number, Nico's drug abuse had gotten worse, and no label or manager would touch her. Seated behind her harmonium, she'd pull stunts like singing the band verses of Deutschland über alles at a concert in West Berlin, or just droning away while her band tried to figure out what was going on. In 1988, having cleaned up and gone on a health kick, she was bicycling on Ibiza when she died of a massive heart attack, aged somewhere between 43 and 48.
Ed Ward lives in Berlin. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Boldonado, Ian Chillog, Patty Leswing, and Sam Brigger. I'm Terry Gross. We'll close with a song sung by John Lennon. He was assassinated 25 years ago today.
When the night has come and the land is dark and the moon is the only light we'll see, no, I won't be afraid. No, I won't be afraid. Just as long as you stand by me.
Support for Fresh Air comes from TIAA Cref, serving the financial needs of those in the academic, medical, cultural, and research fields. Online at tiaacref.org/greatergood. From Warner Brothers Pictures and the producers of Traffic, presenting Syriana, starring George Clooney and Matt Damon. Syriana, in theaters everywhere December 9th. And from members of the American Institute of Architects, committed to designing sustainable communities that enhance people's lives. Good design makes a difference at AIA.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, the original King Kong in his full low-tech glory. We talk with film historian Rudy Belmer and with Mark Cotta-Vaz, who wrote a book about the creator of King Kong. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.